Rensselaer, Urbana, Illinois, coming to you live today from November 2nd, 2008, 2 days before the elections. And today we're going to have an election show with you. Joining us will be journalist David Sirota to discuss the latest developments and what we should expect come November 5th and beyond. So join us today on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The race for the White House has been a long and winding road for Senators Barack Obama and John McCain. At each step of the way, there have been complaints of media bias in the coverage of the candidates. The Project for Excellence in Journalism has been tracking campaign news since January 2007. Its new report, Winning the Media Campaign, analyzes coverage between September 8th and October 16th, that crucial time coming out of the conventions and through the four debates. Associate Director Mark Jerkowitz says the data doesn't provide conclusive answers on the question of candidate bias, but it does show one media bias.
The one bias we can clearly detect is that winning begets winning, and that campaigns that seem to have a positive strategic dynamic, i.e. they're winning in the polls, they appear to be doing well, generally get better coverage.
The analysis shows that press treatment of Barack Obama has been somewhat more positive than negative, but not markedly so. On the other hand, coverage of John McCain has been heavily unfavorable since the second week of the study.
Negative stories don't mean that the authors of those stories are in some ways necessarily writing op-ed pieces that say, I love this guy and I don't like the other guy. They're stories that contain assertions that are negative about the campaign. And as we see, frankly, many of those assertions are really about strategic aspects of the campaign. Not surprisingly, and I don't think it'll shock anybody, more than 50% of the coverage that we looked at in this period was about what we call horse race issues, which is, you know, who's winning, who's losing, polling, strategy, tactics. And only 20% of the coverage was really about policy issues and differences.
The study describes the echo effect of each story, where a behavior or gaffe is first reported. Then the media will measure the political impact of the event, the candidate will comment, and that comment gets analyzed.
What we've very much seen in this campaign is a very episodic coverage that kind of lurches from event to event, controversy to controversy. Part of that is probably because, you know, there is kind of this tendency on the part of the media to focus in on the horse race and then to start to evaluate things on the basis of, could this be a strategic game changer?
On the plus side, because there has been so much coverage, people who have been paying attention can be reasonably well informed on the issues.
There's a lot of sort of where the candidates stand on the issues that's part and parcel of this coverage, even if it's not dominant. I think one thing the media have done pretty well in this campaign is doing a more aggressive job of vetting and fact-checking claims by both candidates. So I think there have been positive aspects.
Jerkowitz likes the fact that news sources are actually breaking stories. But with so many media outlets, there has been a fragmenting of the news and an increase in the partisanship of media coverage.
Some of the biggest scoops in the primary season were done by a reporter for the Huffington Post and a blogger. But if we are living in a country where we're going to have a red media and a blue media, that may be more problematic for us in the future.
For more information about the Project for Excellence in Journalism, go to journalism.org.
What is the scariest thing about the media?
I never know if they're telling the truth.
It's hard to pick. So many things go through my head.
Corrupt ownership and corrupting power.
How badly does its job of informing people and how skewed people's views of the world and our country and our politics and our policies are?
They don't always tell the truth.
Corporate control.
They tell scary stories that don't matter to anybody, except if you're interested in what to wear, what to say, or where to be.
I would say the scariest thing about the media would be all of the makeup that the anchors wear. You can't really tell what their expressions really are, because there's just so much foundation going on.
The scariest thing about the media is the National Association of Broadcasters and their dirty tricks they're sending to the FCC to try to stop white spaces from opening up.
The quality of our journalism has sunk so low that I don't trust the information I get.
No!
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today is November 2nd, 2008, 2 days before a historic election, a historic presidential election, and I think by historical standards, one of the more important elections this country's had in decades. We were planning to have as our guest today the incomparable John Nichols to join us to talk about the races as he's been covering them for The Nation magazine. Unfortunately for us, but fortunately for John, he was beckoned to London to do election commentary on the U.S. elections for the BBC. So John couldn't be with us. He's over in London right now as we speak. Instead, we were very fortunate to get a very short notice. Probably the only person I think who could sit into John's shoes or step into them and hit the ball out of the park, none other than one of our favorite guests on the show, David Sirota, a journalist, author, blogger, columnist, author of the new book, The Uprising, which we've had him discuss on the show already, and also one who writes widely as a columnist on politics, looking at the here and now, but also down the road and sort of having a real talent for putting the historic moment in perspective that we're in. David Sirota, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
Well, I really appreciate you doing this on such short notice, and I know this is your busy time of year as a political writer, so you don't have any time off until well after Election Day. Let's start right in, David Sirota. I've been reading your writings now, thoroughly for months, and especially the last few weeks, and you've been blogging and writing about the upcoming election. Where do you think it stands at this moment?
Well, I think I think it looks pretty good for Barack Obama. I think it looks very good for congressional Democrats. These things are never in the bag until they happen, especially with a historic candidacy like Obama's, the first African American major party nominee. We don't. As much history as we have to go on in terms of where the polls are and what that typically means for a candidate winning or losing, we don't have anything to go on when it comes to a candidate like Obama. So I guess I put a little asterisk on it looking very good for Obama. It does look very good for Obama, but tomorrow is a day that we have never experienced in our country before, so it's a bit of a wild card.
You know, you've been following the Obama candidacy and all the other Democratic candidacies, and Republican for that matter, for the last 2 years. Obama announced, 20 months ago, and he's been running this campaign. What have you learned about Obama over the course of the last 2 years since he started running, and what did you think of his chances for the first year or so that he was in the race?
Well, I think what we've learned is that Barack Obama is a guy who does believe in what I would call consensusism, that the best kind of politics, that the goal of politics in many ways is to find consensus, and I think that is both a positive and a potential negative for him. I think it's certainly been a political positive for him in a year where people, I think, the term unity is a good political term, following an era where that has been known for its divisiveness, thanks to George Bush. So I think it's been a good political tactic, and I certainly think it can create good politics if that term is defined properly. Where I think it can become dangerous is that most of American history is the history of one side passing its agenda, and that act of passage is typically one that isn't necessarily a broad definition of consensus. You know, I mean, anything that passes the U.S. Senate with quote-unquote consensus, you know, 98-1 or 99-0, any of those things that typically pass that way are usually renaming a post office or doing something bad like starting a war or passing a corporate tax loophole into law. So I think the question is not so much as whether Obama's believes in this consensusism, whether or not it's been a good political tactic, it clearly has. But the question moving forward, if Obama is elected, is what that consensusism looks like as a governing strategy. I don't tend to believe that Washington's definition of what centrism and consensusism is one that exists in the public, and I certainly don't think that you can package incrementalism as transformative change. And that's really that's my big question for an Obama presidency. Is he going to take the promises, if he wins, and put them into action? Because many of his promises are very big promises. Or does he believe that he is such a good marketer, such a good spokesperson, that he can package incrementalism as transformative change? I don't think incrementalism can be packaged as transformational change. I don't think you can pretend to do or do small bore things on an issue like healthcare and be such a good orator that you can package it as something transformative on healthcare. And so that will be the question, I think, on November 5th if Obama wins.
It strikes me, David Sirota, that you know when Republicans win elections, in general, they define it immediately, no matter how narrow the margin, as a mandate to do you know their most radical agenda or you know their serious hardcore agenda. And when they win decisively and get lots of Democratic voters, I never hear them say, "Well, since we get a lot of Democratic voters, we'd better do a lot of stuff that will appeal to Democrats to turn their trust since they voted for us." Instead, they say they want us to do what we want to do. And it seems like there's a double standard. I mean, you know, when Obama's lining up to win, I don't hear people saying now he's got to really go out and push the Democratic agenda.
Right. I agree. It is a total double standard, and I think that that it's one that is going to be a big battle to thwart, and there's going to be a big battle to define whatever mandate comes out of this election. I mean, I am of the belief that if Obama wins by one vote, one single vote, one state, that he has a mandate. Just like I believe, by the way, that George W. Bush had a mandate in 2004. But I don't think Bush had a mandate in 2000. Here's why. If elections are defined ideologically in the minds of the public, whoever wins an election like that has a mandate to do what the public clearly chose. So in 2000, there was, you know, Bush was the compassionate conservative. He was muddling on issues like education and immigration. Al Gore was moving to the right. The choice, the ideological choice, wasn't as clearly defined for many people. 2004, you couldn't make the same argument. Everybody knew who George Bush was. He had very clear ideological promises to continue the Iraq War, to privatize Social Security, et cetera, et cetera. And when the country voted for him, even narrowly, I think it was a mandate for those policies. Unfortunately, now I think it's the same thing for Obama. This race, there has not been ideological muddling here. What we've seen at the end of this race is John McCain and Barack Obama, although McCain more so, turning this race into a proxy war over conservative ideology and progressive ideology. John McCain calling Obama a socialist, saying he's wants to redistribute the wealth. Obama saying that the financial meltdown is a referendum on the failed philosophy of John McCain's Reaganism. So the public knows what it's choosing now. It's not a confusing choice. And if the public chooses a guy who's billed as a black Muslim socialist terrorist. Of course, which I think is an unfair characterization. I just want to state that. But that's the billing. If the American public, if 50% plus one vote of the public chooses to vote for that a candidate billed that way, I would say it is an incredible mandate, A, rejecting flat-out conservatism and the conservative movement, and B, if not a mandate for socialism, then at least a mandate for aggressive, progressive economics.
Our guest today on Media Matters is David Sirota. You've just been listening to, author of a couple of books, including the recent and New York Times best-selling book, The Uprising. Also a columnist, blogger. You can find his work everywhere. And it's a real pleasure to have him live with us today on Media Matters. Our phone number here, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment in this special pre-election show, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. David Sirota, I think you have, more than anyone I know, chronicled the pulse of the American people over the last 2 years. You've been out in Montana and Colorado. You've sort of seen this transition of America from, you know, this sort of conservative Republican zone to a far more progressive zone, and all sorts of places that were always considered red states and unable of being to be changed. And, you know, as you look at Obama, you're saying, he's characterized as the most liberal senator, a socialist. As you look at his record, is that what you see? I mean, do you see a soul brother of yours in that sense?
Yes and no. What I would say is I see more of a checklist progressive, and by that I mean a guy who doesn't get in the way of progressive economic reforms, as few and far between as those have been. He's not a guy who likes to triangulate against the progressive movement, and I think that represents a big difference between him and, for instance, the politics of Bill Clinton. Granted, the times have changed, but he's not a guy who likes to stick his thumb in the eye of the progressive movement and his base. So I think that's really good. Now, is this guy an ideological socialist? I mean, absolutely not. And to claim he is, looking at his record, is so silly. It's almost shocking that it's a major meme in the campaign. I mean, this is a guy who is arguably as close to, if not closer to, Wall Street than John McCain. I mean, he's a guy who worked harder to pass the Wall Street bailout, the recent Wall Street bailout, than John McCain, making lobbying calls to members of Congress. He's a guy who's taken, I think, $11 million from Wall Street banks. This is a guy who voted for the class action quote unquote reform bill, making it harder for people to take corporations to court. So I think this guy has got a devoutly moderate voting record on economic issues, regardless of National Journal's scorecard that John McCain cites to show that Obama is supposedly the most liberal senator. I think he's a moderate guy, but I actually think, and this is what I wrote in my last column, that that's less important, at least right now, than the mandate he may receive. You know, if he gets a big mandate, which he may get in this ideologically polarized election, that will give him more running room to be more of a progressive than he may have ever wanted to be. It may pressure him to be more progressive than he may ever have wanted to be. And I think that when you think about it that way, in many ways, if John McCain loses, John McCain will be the first politician in American history to make America safe for socialism. I mean, if not, and I'm saying that tongue in cheek, but the point is, by McCain tarring and feathering Obama as a socialist, and if Obama wins nonetheless, you know, it's not a stretch to say that America, again, if not voted for socialism, then voted for aggressive, progressive economics, perhaps more aggressive than Obama himself had initially reached for.
David Sirota, you've mentioned already the economic bailout package, and what's really not discussed still that much since that package went through, except for the daily stock market reports and sometimes occasionally economic reports, is that we're a long way from being out of the woods on the economic crisis. By all accounts now, we're in the midst of or entering a deep recession, arguably deeper than any since at least 1980 and possibly going back to the 1930s. And the sort of same bag of tricks that other presidents have had, massive debt spending and financial bubbles, isn't really on the table as an option, at least private financial bubbles. What do you think, you know, Obama's looking at as a range of options, and what sort of pressures are going to be on him to deal with the economic crisis?
Well, we've seen it already. I mean, there's been some. The Wall Street Journal had a story about the debate over the bailout. I mean, Obama pushed for it. You know, the way the bailout was structured gives so much power to the Treasury Secretary, such unilateral power to the Treasury Secretary that really, and that was, by the way, an objection that many people had to this bill, that it created a czar. It was very undemocratic, the structure of it. But that will give almost unilateral power to the next president to change around the bailout if they see fit, and assuming the Congress doesn't subsequently amend the bailout proposal. So I think that Obama will be in a position to shape this bailout and make it what it still can be. And by that I mean, you know, there's all sorts of ways that the Treasury can give out taxpayer money that at least at the very minimum prevents abuse. I mean, we're seeing now, you know, billions of dollars go to banks that are simultaneously giving $70 billion worth of executive bonuses to their executives, that are still paying out dividends to their shareholders. I mean, and that aren't, probably worst of all, that these banks aren't lending out more money to regular people. Right? They're not dealing with the credit crisis, which is what the bailout was supposed to be for. So Obama will have a lot of authority to change things around. Now the Wall Street Journal has told us that within his own campaign, he's got on one side people saying you need to make these reforms, you need to call for them now, and if you don't call for them now, when you're president-elect, you need to call for them then, and if not then when you're president, you need to, you know, change it. And on the other side, you have people like Bob Rubin, Bill Clinton's former Treasury Secretary, saying, no, it's okay that the banks are doing this. The goal of the bailout should be simply to right the financial industry, and that's the only thing the government should really, really care about. And so he is going to be between a rock and a hard place. And, you know, the hope is that the bailout, which is already unpopular before it passed, has become increasingly more unpopular as people have learned about what's going on with it. And after, you know, put on top of that a presidential mandate that will be a progressive presidential mandate, you hope that a President Obama surveys that scene and says, you know what, I have to change this thing around.
Our guest, David Sirota. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Coming to you live today on WILL AM 580, November 2nd, 2 days before the election. This is our special Election Day program. Our lines are open if anyone would like to call in with a question or comment at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. David Sirota, author of The Uprising and other books, and a columnist and blogger and commentator. You've probably seen him all over the media over the last month as he's been a frequent commentator on the state of the election and the state of American politics today. One other point, Dave, before we move on to talking about economics. There's been a consensus among, I would say, the liberal economists who come out of the Keynesian tradition that the crisis we're in now economically, which with what they call a liquidity trap, we're just giving money to banks, they aren't going to give it out and lend it, almost definitely requires, in their view, and I'm talking about people like Joseph Stiglitz and Paul Krugman, the two Nobel Prize winners, James Galbraith, the economist at Texas, and I think it really cuts across the whole liberal economic community, calls for a major fiscal stimulus by the government and a huge infrastructure spending. Robert Kuttner, who was a guest on this show a few weeks ago, argues in his new book, Obama's Challenge, that we're talking in terms of $700 billion in hard spending to put Americans to work rebuilding the infrastructure of the country and sort of driving the economy forward and running massive deficits to do so, deficits that would make, John McCain's hair go on fire. Do you think there's a chance that Obama will do this? And do you think it's a good thing for him to consider doing?
Well, I certainly think it's a good idea for him to consider doing. I think that he will be less comfortable with going into a huge deficit, but I think he'll be hopefully more comfortable with paying for at least part of what he proposes to do. And I'll be specific. I think he'll be more comfortable after this election on the issue of taxes, because the issue of taxes has been central. And he has talked about raising taxes on upper income folks, and you can generate a lot of revenue that way. Can you generate $700 billion? You know, I don't know. I don't think so. So the if I had to guess, if you put a gun to my head and asked me, you know, what do I think would come out of that, from Obama at least, it would be a stimulus package proposed with some of the revenues generated from upper income tax cuts, but that the stimulus package itself would be smaller than it needs to be, which I think would be a mistake. I mean, last I checked, John McCain and Barack Obama voted to add $700 billion to the national debt to hand over to Wall Street. You'd think that the rest of the country deserves the same amount, and I think that getting that message across will be the charge of the progressive movement starting on November 5th to make real demands on an Obama administration to really say we're not going to be we'll be led by Obama, but we'll also lead him.
You know, I don't want to beat this drum to death, but my reading of these economists is that unless Obama is willing to do something this dramatic, they anticipate he will be a one-term president, given the severity of the economic crisis he's coming into.
It's hard to second guess or predict, you know, what will happen in 2012. But I do think that you're right, that if the incoming president, whoever it is, does not pursue and enact something very big or a series of very big things, they run the risk of being a one-term president, because small bore proposals will not right this ship. And I think at minimum, Barack Obama, if he is president, needs to get us out of Iraq in his first term, pass a major financial fiscal stimulus to the economy, and if not pass universal health care, then make what will be seen as a very, very concerted and serious effort to do so.
Our guest, David Sirota, the number here, 333-9455, toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Yeah, good afternoon. Like what your guest has to say, and I have a question for your guest. You mentioned the term triangularization that was done by Clinton. Could you explain that term, please, and I'll hang up and listen.
Sure. Triangulation. Triangulation is the term used. It's not actually for a Democrat or a Republican. It can be either. It's when one a leader of a party juxtaposes themselves against their own party in order to validate their independent image in the public's mind. And so when Bill Clinton pushed NAFTA, for instance, joined with Republicans to pass NAFTA, or when he joined with Republicans to pass welfare, quote-unquote, reform, he juxtaposed himself against progressive Democrats in Congress, saying to the country, essentially, look, I'm not a liberal. I'm a centrist. I'm an independent centrist. And as proof, I can cite to you the fact that I am joining with Republicans to pass their priorities as a self-described Democrat.
All right, David Sirota, let me turn back to another subject on the election. We talked about Obama and his campaign. Has McCain's campaign surprised you, the way it's been run, what he's emphasized? Would you have expected this, say, in January, if you were thinking through how McCain would campaign?
It has surprised me in that he has been far less the quote-unquote maverick that he has portrayed himself to be, and that he was actually so successful as during the last decade. He made a decision to move to the hard right, and I've always thought that this guy is a pretty loyal conservative, but you know, he's been an iconoclastic conservative. He has broken with his party's orthodoxy at certain points in his career, but he's decided to present himself as a lockstep Reaganite. And I think that was surprising. I think it was a big miscalculation. And I think it was a miscalculation on two levels. First, I think it was a political miscalculation, in that I think it's helped him, or it's hurt his chances in this election. But I think it's a bigger miscalculation, and maybe he didn't personally care about this, but I think it's a bigger miscalculation for the conservative movement. In doubling down on Reaganism, as his campaign has gone, has started to sputter, he has bet the entire conservative house on his own candidacy. We are not going to, anyone who looks at this honestly, can't look at this election if Obama wins and say, look, it's just one election and it was just a rejection of John McCain. No, John McCain bet the House not on John McCain. He didn't end this election mainly attacking Barack Obama personally. He framed this election as, America, you either choose conservatism or you choose socialism. And in doing that, in betting the House, and if he loses, that means potentially the conservative movement has lost the House. That's not to say that the conservative movement is over, but it is to say that America will have gone on record not just saying we don't want John McCain, but saying something more deep, saying we don't want conservatism.
You know, on that point, David, sort of before we get back to the phone lines, let me do a little follow-up here. If assuming John McCain were to lose on Tuesday, and by all accounts, everyone understands that the Democrats are about to assume commanding leads in both the House and Senate, and they're going to do well in state and local races as well. It appears that we're entering an era in which the Republican Party is going to be out of power and it's going to be weaker than it's been since the Goldwater days of the mid-1960s and really weaker than it's been in a very long time. And with no prospects for really returning to power, where do you think, what's your assessment of the Republican Party and where it's at this point and what its future is in this country?
It's tough to say. I mean, I definitely think that they will be on the ropes. Down, but certainly not out over the long haul. My feeling is that where the Republican Party ends up being for the next generation will be in mostly, certainly not all, but mostly contingent on the success or failure of the Democratic Party at all levels of government, federal, state, and local, to really pass a big agenda that the public actually feels, to deliver real, big, transformative results. If the party does that over the next 4 years, I think it will be increasingly difficult for the Republicans to claw back into power. If the party either, I would say two things. If it doesn't deliver, or worse, if it doesn't make an attempt to deliver big results, I think the Republican Party will argue quite effectively that the Democratic Party has perpetrated a fraud on the public. We are at a moment now, and I've said this before, we are at a moment now where this election is either the election of 32 or the election of 1976. Now, 1932 ushered in a big Democratic era. The election of Franklin Roosevelt ushered in a big Democratic era. The election of 1976 ushered in a momentary Democratic and what could have been a progressive era, but of course 4 years later birthed the Reagan conservative era that we live under. And it birthed that because progressives in that moment didn't both reach for big transformative change or deliver it.
Our guest today, David Sirota. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. We're coming to you live, so the phone lines are open at 333-9455 and our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our toll-free line now, and let's go way up to Anchorage, Alaska. You're on the air with David Sirota.
Thanks a lot for taking my call. Good morning here, Mr. Sirota and Mr. Chesney. My question is, under our current history of national elections, why does the public float into this poll-driven hypnosis about which presidential candidate will win the election? The last 8 years, we've had close elections, and we've had a situation where we thought we had a consensus winner, and come to find out, things turn the other way. And I'll take my answer off the line. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. David Sirota?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I would say this. I think that the reason why is because the media puts the race into horse race terms. I mean, it's in some ways the sportsification of the media, right? Everything has to be, you know, red versus blue. Who's going to win? Who's going to lose? The over/under, if you will. And I think that leads us to follow that. I mean, the media, the symbiotic relationship between our view of elections and how the media presents elections, obviously leads us to focus more on the horse race than on what the race is actually about. And so often the numbers discussed in that horse race context are wrong. And so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It certainly detracts from the democratic, small d, democratic process of what elections are supposed to be about. Elections are supposed to be about accountability and the issues. They're not supposed to be about who's ahead and who's behind in any given moment. I don't know what's going to change that. It's hard to know. But what I can say, and I think that if Obama wins, it will change one part of the media paradigm, or at least it should, which is that you can run a campaign in a different kind of way. You don't have to do the same things that everybody has been doing for years, which is go totally negative, focus only on quote unquote battleground states. I mean, he's ahead here in Colorado, which if you said 4 years ago that an African American politician from Chicago who'd been in the Senate for 2 years and who some publications called the most liberal senator in America was ahead in a state like my state of Colorado, pollsters would look at you like you were crazy. So I think Obama, beyond his policy positions, the way he's run his campaign, structured his campaign, if that is successful, I actually think that it will shift the paradigm about what a campaign looks like when it is successful. And that ultimately, I think, could shift the way these campaigns are covered.
You know, one of the things that's been striking about this campaign, David Sirota, has been the McCain camp has gone to the sort of Karl Rove playbook with William Ayers and the socialist claims. And now apparently they're running Reverend Wright ads in Pennsylvania today and tomorrow as a last-ditch effort. And I think that's what you were alluding to in your answer to some extent just now. Are these Karl Rove that he's associated with, these sort of character assassination politics where you take something largely irrelevant and extraneous and try to drive a truck through it and have the entire public debate center on these absurd, oftentimes absurd issues? Is this a function of the conservatives, or is this something that everyone does and the conservatives are just better at it and that it's always going to be with us?
I think it will always, to some extent, be with us. I think there's a part of it that will always be here. But what I would say is that it's the politics of luxury. And by that I mean we have the luxury of allowing our elections to be about small-bore things like that, manufactured things like that, when times are relatively good. This election is happening in an environment where things are relatively bad. We have a financial crisis. We have two wars raging. We've got an energy crisis. We've got all sorts of really, really pressing national emergencies right now. And the public recognizing that those are national emergencies. And so we don't have the luxury of having a presidential race and our presidential decision being made based on Barack Obama's pastor. I think the public knows that we need to have an election that is making a choice on bigger issues. And so, you know, I think that after this election, if Obama wins, at least in the way elections are covered, perhaps the media coverage will understand that important issues are not just substantively important, but are becoming and have become politically important.
Our guest, David Sirota. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live, so the phone lines are open at 333-9455 and the toll-free line 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Farmer City, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Hello, sir. Hey, you guys are entertaining, but I wanted to ask a question, make a point. I think the election has been bought. All the analyzing is pointless because McCain has been outspent. I mean, this is the RC Cola versus Pepsi Coke debate. If RC was spending as much money on campaigning or on advertising as what Pepsi and Coke did, they'd do as well. But Obama has simply saturated the market with money and advertising, and people are buying it. And I hate to say it, but I wonder what your opinion is, because my personal belief is that all your analysts is pointless if the campaign has been bought.
Well,
I'll listen to you off air.
Yeah, well, I mean, I certainly think it's a valid point that Barack Obama has outspent Barack Obama. No one's claiming that
John McCain.
John McCain. I'm sorry, Barack Obama has outspent John McCain. No one's denying that, and no one's denying that the influence of money in politics is real. No one. What I would say is that you can have two influences happening at the same time. You can, for instance, be outspending your opponent and also have a better message, a message that the public endorses more than the opponent's message, regardless of money. And the reason I think we know that is happening is because we have the empirical evidence. I mean, we have polling on every major substantive issue showing that the public has moved to the progressive left from where it has been over the last 8 years. That's undeniable. So, sure, money is a huge factor in politics. Barack Obama's ability to outspend John McCain is a factor in this election, but it's not the only factor. And I don't think Barack Obama would say it's the only factor, and I don't think John McCain would say it's the only factor. I don't think anybody looking at this would say that Barack Obama won simply by buying the election. I would argue to you that if we have an example of somebody buying the election, it was George Bush in 2000. Here was a guy who offered up an agenda that issue by issue by issue was way out of step with where the public was, again, based on the empirical public opinion data. And yet he fought to a draw because he had raised and spent so much money. So what I'm saying here is that the better argument to make about the supremacy of money is when a candidate wins despite the differences they have on issues with the rest of the majority public. And in this case with Obama, Obama is far more in sync empirically with the public based on public opinion data than John McCain.
David, what do we know about where Obama's money is coming from? I mean, you hear sometimes stories that, you know, he's literally getting, you know, hundreds of thousands, even millions of people who have never given money to before, who aren't part of the traditional fat cat class who write the $2,000 checks, that are filling his coffers, and that it's really a grassroots campaign. But then you also hear the same stories about the huge lobbyists who bundle money and serves commercial interests.
Well, I think it's both. I mean, both truths are true. Barack Obama has raised more money from small dollar donors than any candidate before him. That's absolutely true. But he's also raised, I'm not sure if it's more, but certainly as much, roughly as much as other campaigns have from big dollar donors. So in sum, he's raised more money than almost any, I think more money than any presidential candidate in history. So he has basically done two things at once. He's been a great traditional fundraiser, and he's been a great innovative new fundraiser.
Do you think he'll be supportive of serious campaign finance reform, or as the beneficiary of this sort of his ability to recreate this new system, he'll want to maintain the status quo?
Well, this is an area that I actually have some of the most hope for Obama, that I actually believe that he's not he himself is not a very ideological guy, but I do think he is ideologically committed to campaign finance reform. You look at his career in the Illinois legislature, you look at his promises. I mean, he has taken strong positions on issues like public financing of elections, which unfortunately, that issue in support of public financing of elections, that is still, I would say, fairly radical by the standard of what is considered inside and outside of the debate in state capitals and in Washington. So I have a lot of hope for him on this issue. I think that that it goes along with his sort of reformist sensibilities, that we can't blame him for raising lots of money in a system that rewards people and elects people in part based on how much money they can raise. I mean, you can't ask candidates to unilaterally disarm. When you ask them to do that, you're not asking them for purity or sainthood. You're asking them to be stupid. I mean, they have to play by the rules that exist. But I do think that Obama, more than anybody who will assume that office or who has assumed that office, has a commitment to campaign finance reform, a real campaign finance reform, not the sort of McCain-Feingold put the thumb in the dam, but don't deal with the structural problem kind of campaign finance reform. I'm talking about public financing of elections.
Our guest today, David Sirota. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, Champaign. You're on the air with David Sirota. Yes, line one, are you there? I guess we lost line one. I was hoping to have. So, David, we'll let someone else call in at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. In the meantime, David, you know, you mentioned another huge crisis that awaits Obama, which are the two wars being fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. And Obama's made a lot of noise about wanting to win the war in Afghanistan. What's your take on that?
Well, I think that I wish my take was more concrete. I think that Obama has taken and made good statements on the issue of Iraq. I think he has also made some statements which suggest he may rethink what he's already said. I think that we can look at his legislative record on that issue and draw the same conclusions. A guy who when it was politically opportune, which doesn't take anything away from it, but when it was politically opportune, when he was running in a Democratic primary in the Democratic state of Illinois, he gave a speech against the Iraq War, and I think that was a good thing. But when it wasn't, when it wasn't politically opportune to continue beating the anti-war drum, when he got into the U.S. Senate, he really wasn't much of a voice on the Iraq War. I mean, the guy didn't really talk much about the Iraq War for the first year and a half that he was in the Senate. And he continued to vote for bills that funded the war, and actually at one point made a statement saying that that he didn't want to play chicken with President Bush over trying to stop the war. So, you know, I'm not sure what Barack Obama will do when he gets in, when and if he gets into office as president on the Iraq War. What I can say is this: is that if he doesn't end the war or make a significant step, I'm not talking about 25,000 troops or 30,000 troops, really a significant drawdown of troops from Iraq in his first term, I think he will run the risk of losing a lot of political support. I think this is one of the foundational expectations people have for his presidency, and I think that that if he plays around with that, if he dances around the issue, he's playing with fire politically.
Yeah, just to go back to Afghanistan, though, just the intelligence reports and all the news accounts now make it sound like Afghanistan is a explosive situation. The United States is in danger of being defeated. And the sort of commitment Obama's committed to sort of win, or at least, I don't know what the objectives are there, but to do whatever they want to do in Afghanistan, could possibly get us into a war that would, you know, be a huge war.
I agree, and I think he's been much more bellicose on the issue of Afghanistan. And you know, the issue with Afghanistan is that there's good arguments on both sides. There really are. You know, I think there are good people who are not warmongers who are saying we have to do a better job of securing the situation there, and we've taken our eye off the ball. There are others who say, you know, we don't want to get drawn into what the Soviets got drawn into in Afghanistan.
Or the British.
Or the British, right. I mean, this is historically one of the places that sort of empires go to die, if you will. So That said, I mean, I think you look at the, and I'm not an Afghanistan expert, but I can say this. If you actually look at the troop levels we're talking about, I mean, we have 140,000, 150,000 troops in Iraq. We have, I think by last count, what is it, 20,000, 15,000 in Afghanistan?
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. So in other words, a percentage-wise, a quote-unquote larger, major buildup in Afghanistan, let's say you doubled the troop force in Afghanistan to 30,000, you're still talking about 30,000 troops in Afghanistan versus 150,000 troops in Iraq. So my point here is not to take a side on a very complicated issue, but merely to put this in resource and force perspective here. That the Iraq War, the reason why it's, I think, such a bigger issue is because it's such a much bigger portion of our budget, of our manpower, and our resources.
Our guest on Media Matters, David Sirota, you've been listening to, author, columnist, blogger, media commentator, political analyst. We have three callers waiting patiently. I'm going to try hard to get all three on the air before we check off in 8 minutes. Let's start right first with line one. Champagne, you're on the air with David Sirota.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have two questions, and they probably are related, but John Dean has been writing for years about Republicans are really good about getting elected and wanting to rule, and Democrats are better at trying to govern. And those two things are certainly different because of the approach that you take in trying to strong arm the opposition and that sort of thing. And the other thing I wanted to ask about is the secrecy that the Bush administration has developed into an art form. Do you think that Obama would change that secrecy and challenge some of the anti-constitutional things that the Bush administration has put into place? And I'll listen for your answer.
Thank you very much, caller.
Well, I mean, I think, look, on the issue of ruling or governing, I mean, I definitely think that the Bush administration has ruled in the narrow sense of that, in the real epitome of that word. You're right, trying to strong arm the opposition. Look, I think Democrats could use a little bit more spine that George Bush does unfortunately have, and by that I mean we've suffered. I think our country has suffered from a Democratic Party that hasn't been willing to impose its will on the political system, not one that has too much done that. So I hope that Obama, if Obama wins and Democrats retain Congress, that they get a little bit more comfortable actually doing what they were elected to do. On the issue of secrecy, you know, I'm of two minds of this. One is that Barack Obama, this sort of transparency thing, is, again, part of his reformist idea. He passed the Google for Government bill, which opens up a lot of these federal contracts to the public to see. But he's also a guy who switched his vote on the issue of FISA, the secret wiretapping. And so he's, record-wise, he's moved around a little bit on secrecy issues, just a little bit, although that's an important issue. But even more important is that, you know, presidents don't like to give up power, you know, and the ability of a president to classify or hide information within their administration, presidents generally don't like to give that up. That's why when Congress allows the president to expand their powers of secrecy, most often American history teaches us that Congress is giving it away permanently because the next president isn't about to give up power.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line two, Champagne, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with David Sirota.
Hi, I just have a couple of comments. One of them is kind of directed at the guy from Farmer City, and I live on a block in Champaign. I still live on a two-block street that has, count them, 8 Obama signs on this little two-block street and no McCain signs. It's a very modest street. And I know that, personally, I don't contribute to political parties, and I very rarely in my 60-some years here have opened my wallet to any of these people. But I have contributed to Obama, and I think a lot of other people on this street also have. I think that the other thing is when we're trying to talk about, you know, what people have if people do elect Obama, what they have elected. I think that what they are electing is the calm, the reason, the non-ideological, the problem-solving Obama. And I think it would be wrong to think that they have necessarily elected somebody because they are, you know, have all of a sudden decided to be more progressive. I think they are rejecting the hysterical, the fear-mongering, and this is where I think that people are really coming down. And then I think that what people are hoping, especially people who are more progressive, is that Obama will be the leader that will help people move into things that are in their own best interest. And I hope that the people who consider themselves more progressive and blah, 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 you know, and who tend to, in my opinion, you know, look at somebody, and if they're not, you know, ideologically, you know, perfect here in terms of being more progressive, give them a hard time. I hope that people who are progressive and who themselves see what needs to be done know that Obama is going to have to spend some time leading if he's going to be successful.
Well, thank you very much, caller. David, any comments?
Well, I think it's hard to parse out that people want calm, non-fear-mongering, pragmatic government. In contrast to the Bush administration, I think it's hard to parse out which part of that is a personality question and which part of that is an ideological question. I mean, conservatism, modern conservatism by its nature, governs with the use of fear, with the use of strong-arm tactics, and progressive politics typically hasn't. So I just think it's hard to parse out. What we can parse out from the data, from what people are telling pollsters, is that most people who are supporting Obama say that they support him because they believe he will represent, and he does represent them rather than the wealthy. Now, that is a progressive reason for supporting Obama. I mean, the Republican Party tells us, you know, what's good for GM, what's good for the billionaires, is good for America. Progressives say that there is a choice, that in order to be good for America, you have to actually make sure that the policies are aimed at helping most Americans. So the reason people are telling us that they're supporting Obama is fundamentally a progressive ideal. And finally, you know, I don't think it's, you know, up to progressives after the election, after voting for Obama, to simply sit there and cheer on whatever Obama does, whether it's conservative or not very progressive, left. The point being here is that we don't help make change by simply clapping for the leader. We make change by forcing the leader to do what he may not want to do. If you think Franklin Roosevelt was successful during the New Deal because the labor unions clapped their hands at everything he did, then you're crazy. I would suggest you go read some history and realize that the labor unions were making serious demands on Roosevelt, were criticizing him like crazy to create the space for him.
David Sirota, unfortunately, I hear the band tuning up in the background, okay, which means they want to clear us out of the studio. You're just getting warmed up, too.
I was.
Thank you so much for joining us today, David Sirota, here on Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. Thank you, listeners. And thank Andrew Boyle, my producer. Be back 167 hours, and everyone, be sure to vote on Tuesday.